Huh?
You wouldn't thank me.
I need a water. So this is one of the longest titles you can ever imagine. I wanted to make more longer, but I held myself in check. So this talk is about randomized representation of integers in elliptic recursive systems for speeding up the computation as well as resisting side channel attacks. Now, should be other applications, but I can't think of it. It's actually a joint work with David Jha, who, it doesn't mean that Microsoft Research implies University of Waterloo. He went from Microsoft Research to University of Waterloo, and Ramesh Raju is a PhD student in IIT Madras. The whole paper came into existence because in one IndoCrypt, there was a paper presented as to how to characterize particular set, but it looked like as if people are trying to write down explicit formulas of prime numbers. So I thought that maybe we should randomize it, and then that's how we got into the problem. But first, before I go to that, I would like to bring your attention to something very familiar problem. Everyone's supposed to know this, and so I don't have to talk about it, but okay. So many of the things I'm going to talk today is going to look like collapse problem. And I didn't know about this name for this problem until David Jha pointed out what the name of this. The problem is that you're given an integer n, and if I don't know, it probably has nothing to do if it's even, divided by 2, and if it's odd, multiply by 3 and add 1. An example is that you start with n equals 6, you go 6 is even, divide by 3, it's odd, multiply by 3 and add 1, and so on and so forth until you get, suddenly you get 1, and for some reason you stop. And n equals 11, you select slightly longer, you end up getting a sequence which ends in 1. Now, the algorithm that we're going to keep on displaying in this talk is going to look something like that. If f of n equals to, if n is n 2 mod, 0 mod 2, divide by 2, otherwise multiply by 3 and add 1. Okay. This algorithm we're going to write is going to look very similar to this all the time. And sometimes I have to warn you that if you try to do it for 27, it'll take a lot longer. I stole this data from Wikipedia website. The collapse problem is so famous that it has to have a Wikipedia website. That's how you know some problem is famous. And it goes all the way up to 9,232 before it decides to come down to 1 again. So what are we talking about? The conjecture is that now the problem is the same thing anyway. The conjecture is it always end up in 1. So it's kind of aggravating because if you look at this particular equation, with some probability half you will divide it by 2, but with probability half you will multiply it by 3. So you'll expect that it'll keep going up and up and up, but for some reason it comes down. And sometimes it can take even longer. Actually, we ran experiments in which it went quite a while, even for small numbers. So the question that will be interesting to this particular talk, which you'll see later, how long will it take to end? But unfortunately, none of this is resolved. Okay, our problem will be similar, but we will be forced to give precise bounds for it, and therefore we'll have to find a different formulation than that one. And this actually is the okay. So there's also a talk called, this talk is also about side channel attacks. One part is about collapse problem. It also has a leverage to side channel attacks. This is the scene from the latest James Bond movies. So if you know this particular movie, which if you have already seen it twice, you will know, like me, you will know that, yeah, first of all, myself, second. No, I actually took my son for the second time. Okay, so the thing is that there is a card game going, there are rules for the card game, and you have to obey the rules, but these people are sitting and looking at everybody, whether they're scratching this way or scratching that way, and one fellow goes, my God, he's right, he's bluffing his hand and things like this. You know, all these people are reading all kind of side channel material all the time. And but the main point, one of the points is that, one more interesting and important point for this talk is that in crypto we always talk about keeping secrets and evaluating some functions, but I will as well point out some recent attacks. It's very difficult to keep a secret in a program and execute it. For example, RSA secret or AES secret. There are lots of unexpected attacks coming up. So the dirty secret about crypto is that you can't keep a secret. So all these things will be relevant for this particular talk, and I'll go back to originally scheduled programming. So let's talk with the very simple. I'll keep the talk very simple and example oriented, so that you won't get bored. If you get bored even after that, I don't know what to say. So if you have a D set equal to 0 and 1, and it's a usual binary base, we know that every integer can be uniquely represented. It's obvious. Supposing I extend the base to add minus 1, this is good. So there's a minus 1 there, right? Yeah, I'll use the official release. Okay, minus 1. Then it's clear that either you can use 0 or 1, or when you get a chance, use minus 1, and therefore the extension will not, the thing will not be unique. And so M could be expressed as a sum like this, that BIs are 0, 1, and minus 1. But if you require that no two successive digits are non-zero, I mean, this amount of double negative is always entertaining. I have to work on it. So basically what this means is that 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, there are two successive ones. We don't want representations like this. We throw them out. Then it turns out that the representation then becomes unique. Okay, and this has got a name, and it's called non-adjacent format. Therefore, I didn't discover it. And if you generalize it, 0, 1, and x, and the x is minus 1, it is known that you get unique non-adjacent format for each integer n. But this is not true for every x. Okay. The way this is actually studied in detail by a paper by Muir and Stinson, and it contains a lot of valuable information where you can glean and get some intuition about this problem by reading this paper, and it also gives good performance improvements. So in this particular talk, what we will do is that we will try to randomize x. Okay, and that's the main, and we'll also make the set bigger. And I will try to show why it is worthwhile, what you get out of it, and how do you get to analyze it. So what non-adjacent format is good for is that it starts by saying that no two successive digits are non-zero. Wow, I said it. So this means you get uniqueness and for some basis. And it makes it, because it's no two things are, you're really putting a moratorium on things which are non-zero, it gets to be, encourages things to be sparse. I don't know that it gets succeeding it, but we are interested only in sparsity, not in uniqueness. And but the point is that it will be sparse, and typically what will happen is the 60% of the entries will be zero. It does not immediately mean that you get so much amount of proportional efficiency. I'll tell you why it is. The reason why it actually becomes efficient is because in elliptic curves, multiplication by minus 1 is almost for free. It's as easy as addition. And it can be, in some cases, up to 25% more efficiency. So going back to the set about d equals 0, 1, x, for some good values of x, you'll get a NAF. And if I give you x, if I ask you to find out whether it's a NAF or not, the best algorithm takes x over 12 steps to test, approximately. If you want to write down, there are formulas, there are conditions under which for x you'll get the x will be good, but this looks like a very non-trivial exercise. It's almost as if you're trying to write down a close formula for primes. This is actually rather a funny thing to say, but we did a lot of experimental work around this, and it looks like a good proportion of x's must have actually yield these kind of things, but there's no hope of proving it actually. There's a huge list of tables of x for which this is known, but when x is equal to minus 1, to prove that the density is about 60%, there's a very complicated paper, which is lots of recurrence equations. It's close to 20-page proof. You may argue that the page is small or something, but the page, I think something like 20 pages proof on this one. Now I'll tell you how to compute this formula. Okay, it's going to look like this. So what you're going to do is that you're going to take an integer n, and it's going to be relative to a base d. If n is equal to 0 mod 4, you're going to divide it by 4. And if it's 1, since you want to divide by 4, you might as well subtract 1 and then divide it. If it's 2, you divide by 2. Otherwise, 3, what's going to happen is that the x is going to be 3 mod 4. You choose it, therefore you're allowed to divide it. So somehow you're bent on dividing numbers. And what you're going to do is that you're going to start encoding the numbers depending on this outcome as 00001000X, because you have used X here. Okay, so roughly it's going to happen. And so even before, don't have to remember this, why is it useful and what are we going to say in general? The bird's eye view point of view is that we're going to give you a general way to construct this sparse format where you can pick many X's, and C will be of the form 2 to the n minus 1, n greater than 0. And we will give you a very simple proof based on, of all things, Markov chains. And the analysis is dramatically simple, and I'll show you the proof, complete proof for the case for 1. And the proof is for average case. That means that when you're trying to express a random integer, what will happen? In fact, in crypto, all we'll encounter will be random integers anyway. And we can actually even compute the convergence rates. Typically, I'll show you a plot. The convergence is in 5 to 10 steps, the f of f function you saw before. It actually reaches some kind of steady state in a formal way. So basically, average analysis is pretty close to reality. So I'll show you some examples. So this number k, I don't know what it represents, is a very long binary string. And we would end up using a base like 0, 1, and these numbers, and you'll get a very long representation. It'll contain strings of the form 0, z, and lots of zeros. And 1, 1, 1, or x or y, you can see that it's flooded with zeros. And sometimes these expressions can get very long, okay? And I would like to tell you how to actually deal with all these difficulties and when they go along. It's very easy, actually. And a typical expression will be paired with lots of zeros, and once in a while there'll be x and y's available. And this kind of system is not possible for RSA, because in RSA, multiplying by minus 1 will corresponding to taking inverse, which is actually as difficult as just computing the full exponentiation. So for that, there is another trick we need to use. They are actually centered around data structures. I wouldn't be able to say anything about them here. Okay, so everybody knows about the ECC scalar multiplication. Given P and K, you have to compute Q. So I won't bother you too much with this one right now. So basically what we're going to do is that's a bird's eye view that we are going to generalize these sets, base sets, by containing lots of points, 0, 1, x1 through xc, where x1 through xc will be random numbers. Typically, you'll pick very small xi's for performance and big xi's for security, the thing we are going to talk about. So let me motivate the security aspect of it. This is basically side channel attacks. Side channel attacks, I'm not a good expert on side channel attacks some time ago, probably even not now. So I asked asked the student to find all the papers that are available on side channel attacks and put it on and then bind it up. So he actually walked in and then gave me like 3 volumes of papers like this. So it's like really all of them are unique papers. He said yes, and they actually alphabetically sorted according to time. And instead, it's not even the whole story. So there are lots of side channel attacks being papers being written. The titles are actually hilarious. I don't remember them now. Some of the titles like. Somebody will say on the efficacy of certain theme, and somebody will say on the comments on the efficacy of something, and then there's another paper about on the comments on the. This is like almost people are writing letters in the titles itself. So the side channel attacks are actually kind of very difficult to formalize. So there's a class of implementation attacks and type of. I'll just give you a picture. So. Whenever you see something red color, it means a possibility for side channel attack. And that's the only thing we know about. So you are given a number, numbers K and P, they go into CPU, and they come out as Q, K times P. Now, there's a power line somewhere, and there's a cache, that's a red line, red and cache, it's supposed to be yellow color. So this is the cache, and there's a cache line. And then there's the electromagnetic radiation. I know nothing about them. Apparently you can use the attack, and then finally this timing attack with a clock. So the power source could be monitored, the cache line could be monitored, the EMR transmissions could be monitored. This I understand that there are attacks which you can have a pocket handheld things which really take your secrets out of some cards while you watch it. So there are lots of attacks, and there's no good model for all of these things. So there's a very idea, by very definition, side channel attack is something which creeps upon you without you knowing what it is. And everybody knows about timing attacks, which is basically tells you about, okay, I don't mean that if you don't know, you are nobody. But so an attacker infers the secret by information by using computational time as leaked by data. And this has become a problem, and you know, recently even product groups in Microsoft are shipping corrections for timing attacks and other kind of side channel attacks. It is, that means that people are actually getting some heat, even if they don't work, at least they get the press work. But some of the attacks actually really work. Power attacks, these are actually very powerful. There's a simple power analysis, differential power analysis, and then cache-based attacks. This is actually really very interesting line of work, where Shamir and Tromer introduce this kind of attacks, where basically you watch the memory access pattern, and if there's a page fault or a cache fault, you use it to derive the keys. And you don't even need to know the plain text ciphertext. You only know the statistics of it. And I had very long conversations with Tromer, and so currently what you can do is that you can actually have this ActiveX control or something like download it, and you can get the AES key in about 30 milliseconds. And so that's actually pretty interesting thing. And there were the one thing about this cache attack as opposed to timing attacks is that you cannot release a patch for every one of the algorithms in a uniform fashion. You have to work on them, every single one of them separately, and then make a correction. And you will make a mistake in it anyway. Or overlook some model, I don't know where it's going to end. So, electromagnetic, I know nothing about them, but I know the papers what they say. So basically, these are the main topics which will be relevant to us. And I will now describe you how to do the random sparse formats. So basically, this is the case in which you have sets of the form 0, 1, x, y, z, where x, y, z are small numbers, okay, like 1, 2, 3, or single-digit numbers. So let's go back to the algorithm that we just saw, which is to say f of d will be, like we saw before, written. This is basically because it's cut down from a paper and pasted. So it's definition 2.4 in the paper. So the f of d equals to n over 4, this divisible by 4, this algorithm is was one thing which is worth focusing on. And what really is going to happen is that we're going to analyze the distribution. So since our digits that are output by GD of n depends upon which case you hit, okay? Supposing you knew that you hit this track with some frequency, and this track with some frequency, and this track with frequency, this track with some frequency, you'll know exactly how many zeros are there in the algorithm. So it suffices to figure out exactly how many times you're going to hit each of these tracks. Sorry, yes?
What is D and
U by D? D is something I wrote down in the base, 0, 1, comma, X. Yeah. Yeah. So we're going back to the same thing again. Yes, correct. So basically it's like a collapse problem. Every time N is reducing, and every time n is reducing, you're generating an output 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, x. If you know that, I never come to this these two positions, I'll be outputting completely zeros. And you hope to hit these two tracks much less often than the other ones. But even if you hit them uniformly, you'll get a good percentage of zeros. Now, while collapse problem, it looks very close to collapse problem, but the point is that this is an algorithm from classic, this is nothing new, it's a classic algorithm, as far as this area goes. You can thoroughly study this in papers, including Muir and Simpson's papers. But the algorithm, to analyze the performance of this one, first we actually make there's an assumption that if you have a number alpha, which is being fed in this number, I didn't want to confuse alpha and d, it'll have this correct format if and only if fd of a, after applying this one, it has a NAF also. So what it tells you is that if alpha is a binary number represented like this, and fd of alpha is a binary string like that, base 2, FDF alpha is a binary integer, you can express it as a binary string, then the whole number will be concatenation of the values you got for FD and the value you got from GDF alpha. So you can actually iteratively run this algorithm to compute this. So recursive algorithm to compute this, to compute NAP representation for this, and then concatenate with that of GD alpha. So it's a very simple algorithm. Now, okay. So we'll keep it in the corner like that. So what we're going to do is that we're going to take with alpha and iterate alpha 1, then feed it again alpha 2, alpha 3, it's going to keep going like that. So the execution depends only on the sequence of alpha i's that you're going to hit. And this will determine the frequency distribution. If you knew the distribution of alpha i's mod 4, you'll know exactly what the output distribution would be. And this is what we'll try to study. We want to understand the distribution of alpha i mod 4 for a random alpha. I don't think this, we are not magicians enough to study for arbitrary alpha. I think that is actually properly a subject in ergodic theory. We want something very simple and easy to understand. So, okay, we repeated it enough. Now, by assumption, alpha is uniformly distributed in 0 and n, where n is the range for it. Now, if alpha is 0 mod 4, notice that alpha 1 will be also uniformly distributed among all congruence classes. It's a very simple observation. And if alpha is 1 mod 4, alpha minus 1 mod 4 is also uniformly distributed in all congruence classes. But however, if alpha is 2 mod 4, this means that alpha divided by 2 will be odd, and therefore it can be only 1 or 3 mod 4, but never be 2 or 0 mod 4, trivial thing. But if alpha is 3 mod 4, then there's the same conclusion. So what really happens is that if you consider a probability distribution vector which contains 4 entries for congruence class 0, 1, 2, and 3, you know that if alpha was a vector, if you have a probability distribution for the vector here, initially it's going to be all uniform. And then what it is telling you is that in next step, what will be the distribution you'll get for the alpha i's modulo 4. So basically what's going to happen is that you're going to get a matrix. This is actually another way of saying that we saw that it's uniformly distributed, it's only odd, therefore it can never be 2 or 3, and this is the one which says all uniformly distributed. So this comes to the initial vector is P0 is 1, 4. The probability distribution over all possible values you will get for alpha on the ith step. So on the zeroth step, since alpha is uniformly distributed, you're going to get all 1 over 4. That's pretty close. So P1 will be the distribution of the values of alpha I is modulo 4. After the first step will be A times P0, which will be a vector like this. That means for a random alpha, if you computed the frequency, how many times it falls here, it'll be 3 over 16 for the first coordinate, 5 over 16, 3 over 16, and 5. It's not uniform because it is not really uniform there either. And P2 will be like this. I'm not going to show you millions of vectors. I'm going to, like a gentleman, put PJ eventually goes to a vector, pi goes to this vector. And you can actually prove this. Now, this is actually a constant dimension matrix, and you can analyze the Markov chain completely, and you can get the correct proofs for everything you want. But this matrix is not symmetric, so you cannot do eigenvalue analysis simply based on,
So 60% comes from the
3 times? Yeah. 60% comes by taking this distribution, and yeah, you take the average over both of them. So the transient analysis, so it's always good to do average analysis, but Markov chains have a transient period. It could be very long, and the bounds you get may actually be meaningless. In practical application, you're not doing an infinitely long binary string. It's only 160 bits of data in alpha, used typically. So you would like to know how long it takes. But surprisingly, by the time it hits 5 iterations, it's already get too tired. It's already convergent. And there's a good reason for it. You can actually calculate these things formally. I'll actually show you something like this in case you don't believe me. this also I cut and pasted from a paper. I was at 2 o'clock in the morning last night. So basically, if eigenvectors corresponding to largest eigenvalue, second eigenvalue are given by pi and pi prime, then you can compute the angle between them. Then you can completely figure out how this norm of A to the K P0 minus phi drops, and you can plot it. Now, and then you can go ahead and say that if you pick the x is equal to 3 mod 4, and if you look at the distribution of this one, eventually it'll go there, and this particular analysis works for any x. And for x is equal to minus 1, the previous proof, which proves essentially the expectation, you don't even get a variation for how fast it dies. It's extremely long, and lots of recurrence equations. I'll never be able to write such a thing. It's too complicated. So this is simple. I can write it. Now, what happens if you have three numbers, x, y, z, and you know you have to make some adjustments? Then the equations are going to look like this. So basically, if it's 0 mod 8, you take cut and run, you know, divide by 8, and you know, you can write these equations following your nose. Then the corresponding encoding will be also obvious to write. But then you'll get a very big matrix of size 8 by 8. The analysis of this matrix on this transient is far more complicated than the 2 by 2 case. But you still can do the whole thing again. And one would like to show that for a... I didn't do it. What? Maybe it is over. Okay. Okay, this is a... 20 or 27 or something. That's a secret. It's only that 8 possibilities, so... I think I can find it. By the time when I did it, it was 2 o'clock, so... So, but the final distribution is known, clearly. This is for 3. I think it comes to closer to 75% of the things are 0, and it converges quickly to what you want. The proof of this also is pretty simple, but in the case of 8 by 8 matrix, you have a non-symmetric matrix, and if you would like to show that, for example, the digit 3 occurs, you know, 1 over 8 times, and the deviation from its mean is exponentially dropping off. That becomes a very tricky thing to prove. I do not know exactly how to prove it in a general case. For this matrix, I can show. But in general, doing this kind of analysis shows that not only you get the expectation, but the exponential drop-off is very fast in a general way. It's actually a pretty difficult thing to do. If it's a symmetric matrix, then we know how to do it. If it's not a symmetric matrix, it's difficult. Okay. So basically, I'll go through more slides. If you want, I can give you the most general construction and its complete algebraic proof. So topic number 3 is that examples and performance. This is prepared by David Zhao. So I'll just go and show you one particular example, which is pretty good. There's more correct history in case I messed up my references in the other one. You may want to actually see why you get some gains in elliptical algorithms when you use this format. So it's kind of you would think that it should be obvious, but you get a little bit better intuition if you do 15p with binary representation. Everybody knows, but in a NAF representation, you get 15 represented as 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, -1, 2. So you find 2p, 4p, 8p, 16p, but the representation directly tells you to subtract it exactly once. So it's like pretty fast compared to previous ones. Okay, this is the thing I wanted to show. So if you take random sets of x, y, z's and the axis, you know, various type of base sets, and if you compute the runtime of these algorithms and take under trials, you can plot how much time it takes. And this is the one which is standard binary operation will have a flat timing. So basically, you would expect that this will give very little time against timing attacks, but it's not entirely true. But this one is actually a little bit faster than the previous ones. So we did do the timing one on this. Okay, and finally, then we'll now consider the, probably might finish much earlier than. I'll now go back to side channel attack and see. So if you finish on this side channel attack arguments, we'll go to a more complicated proof on the analysis of the other algorithm. So side channel attacks, is no clean models are known. You know, who's going to know which power, you know, it may be that there's a side channel attack, which is even more funnier than the other ones, is that you, Shamir and Kromer have an attack in which they place a microphone next to your computer and they record the audio. They can tell you when you're computing RSA and which kind of bits you're going with. They cannot recover the key yet, but pretty much from the plot they can tell you when you're computing RSA, when you're doing something else. And you know, to refine the attack, maybe just the best way to spy is to just drop a, you know, microphone somewhere and you can get it. So we can never model side channel attacks in a very clear way. It could be paradoxical in some sense, it's because it's outside the model. So for example, in the Bond movie, he scratches his head and then they figure out he's lying, but then he's using it to fool others, you know, who knows what's going on. So the idea is that side channel attacks are pretty difficult to model, and there's a differential power attack. So some of the attacks make me think that they're probably not completely well documented. But nevertheless, some of the things I've heard about from people make me believe that this is probably going to get much worse than before it gets better. So I'll say what I'll call it as an open time memory model. This is the adversary's eyes. So this is the CPU, very closely watching it. So I'm going to make a weird assumption that there's a small secure piece CPU. The idea is that think of it as a smart card or a heavily software protected something. So for a model, it's a secure CPU, and he doesn't get to see this one thoroughly. And you have a main memory. So all the addresses accessed in the main memory are revealed to the adversary. So you get to see every one of them. And all timing information is also revealed to him. Then why not give the rest? So what this means is that if you're going to do all the timing information, you know, don't bother, I'm giving it to you right away. So you win already. And this is kind of a model we started working on like 3 or 4 years ago. And we have some data structures, results, which tell you how to work in this environment, which are efficient, provable, and all that. But the question is that, you know, if the main memory is completely should be, access pattern should be revealed to the attacker now, because if in case you, probably some of you might have seen this paper by Tromer et al. I described to you, it's actually pretty reasonable in figuring out, and on a repeated run, where you're accessing. And it's pretty, you can actually think that we may be able to get out of it, and maybe in many applications you can't, but let's assume that you reveal all the memory locations and all the timing information and see what happens in this particular system. So let's go back to what do you mean by timing attack. You said let RSA be a secret, and timing attack finds D bit by bit, you know, multiply or square. But the point is that once you know the representation of D, it's same as knowing D. But if you have a base in which 0, 1, x, where x is a pretty large integer, it looks paradoxical, but for a moment assume that x is not known to you. Even then, there is some information is not known to you about x. So this gives you an idea that maybe in practice, somebody doesn't get all the bits, but still he has a block about what he will learn from the timing attack. So we'll assume that an integer will be represented with base 0, 1, x, y, z. There will be many of them. This notation is due to Andre Weil. I never guessed that somebody could write x, y, dot, 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 z. But anyway, the adversary will use timing and memory access information to find the representation. So we just give it to him. Thus, he will know the digits of the representation. So if you have alpha represented as a digit, he will completely know. But we'll assume that he's not going to know x, y, z. We will be probably keeping it small. We have managed to do it in pre-processing. We cheat by using secure hardware or using secure software, if there's such a thing. So somehow you try to assume that the small values are not known and ask a question whether what kind of information does he get. In fact, it's not easy to show This is actually useful. I don't know why you stopped that. So what we're trying to show is that now, supposing you have a base 0, 1, x, y, z, and you do not know the x, y, z's, but you know the bit format, like string, can you say that how many, it may be that for a particular bit pattern, there are too many alphas which map to the same thing. Then that would be a bad thing. So what we would like to do is to show that we pick a random basis and express A in the basis, we expose the digits of A, how much information is leaked about A. It's a simple game. In the case of one bit, it's actually very easy. You have a D, 0, 1, and X. Given alpha P and the digits of the attacker, you'll immediately know A and B, some numbers A and B, where A is the set of all location, you know, sum of 2 to the I, where I was the digit 0, you know, not 0, 1. So you basically can compute two numbers A and B such that alpha P will be equal to A plus X times B. And it doesn't know X, so you can try to solve this equation using polar kangaroo and all that. But so this will be the first starting base point. But the disadvantage in this trick is that if you want the X to be very large, you actually will pay a lot of penalty by pre-computing X times. So for this to work, you have to compute X times P and store it in some device, right? You don't have to know, you don't have to store the value of all X somewhere. You have to store the X times P. If X times P itself is big enough, it's not a very entertaining thing to do. So you would like to keep X small enough. But if X is small, then there's not too much degeneracy if you know the values of A and B. So you'll have to actually keep many small X's and try to see whether you can get some advantage out of it. So given alpha P and A0, A1, A2, this is learned from the side channel attack, it's solved for X and Y such that alpha P equals to A0 plus AX, A1 plus Y, A2. It's a very simple problem. And you can bound the number of solutions for this by this nice formula, which shows that it's basically what you do is that you divide out by the, it's an analysis of the equation of the form AX plus BY equal to C, and you're counting the number of solutions. And by using, this actually bounds the number of solutions for the equation, and it shows that for a typical case, given an alpha P, there'll be only one solution, which will have the same bit format. And if you have three, so I'll write down again. So it's X, Y, Z, there are three numbers you can compute from the side channel attack, A0, A1, A2, A3, and then you, where A0 is the set of places where A was 1, X, Y, and Z, and then you need to count, bound the number of solutions as this, then you can compute the formula to be something like this. Now, it may be the excessive paranoia to reveal all these numbers to the attackers, but it gives you a baseline as to how much you will lose, and in case in many applications you can actually do some small pre-computations for XP, YP, and ZP, this may be a viable method of doing. There are some situations in which you can use it. You cannot use this method. And there are some situations you would like to use it. For example, there are so-called white boxing applications where the secret itself is in the software and or the hardware, and you would like to hide it as much as possible. It's a hopeless task currently, but it could be used in that particular position too. So in a general case, there's a formula which tells you all of them saying that given an alpha P, there's at most one solution. So what we gain from this is that even if somebody learned everything about your runtime of the algorithm and everything, there's still some amount of entropy that is left out. And if you're really paranoid, saying that anyways people are going to figure out all my secrets using side channel attacks, you can actually have another backup method of doing this particular case. And finally, I would like to just give you the feel for the okay, I'm probably not going to say everything. Hopefully not. So you can actually generalize it to a case in which the whole thing is written like lots of C's and 2 to the n minus 1. And there's a necessarily ugly formula, which I don't know how to simplify it. But this is a matter of writing down everything and then you can prove that this is correct, and you can compute some very interesting statistics for the probability distributions explicitly. And okay, you understood all of that. And we can do the same spectral analysis, and you can actually plot it. So there's a final theorem which says that on the average, you can find out you can give a precise estimate for how many bits will be zero. Okay, that's it. So the only thing is that by randomization, we are avoiding a lot of deep number theoretic problems and getting very precise results that we want, and we get something extra and benefit. Say it again. Oh, okay, good point. So, excellent. Yeah. So, there will be cases in which, okay, the sequence. So, for example, if you have a. So, because it's sparse, necessarily the length will be longer than a binary representation, and at times it will become much longer, right? There's no way to bound this specifically. So one way out, which is included in the testing of these timings, is that once, if you look at the formulae, how many minutes do I have? Couple of minutes? Okay, good. Okay, somebody's calling me in Messenger. Okay, good. Usually factors numbers first. Okay, there. So the only time, so typically what happens is that since x is negative, right, all these steps are going to, decrease the value of n. Okay. When n is pretty big compared to x, right, dividing by 4 is going to drop the value again. But when n is comparable to x, because n is decreasing, it has to hit to that place, then this value will go up, okay? And it can go up and down and up and down and all that stuff. So what you can do is that you can actually design a stopping point at which you can default your binary case, or start using smaller values of x. And you can recursively go until you get bored. Yeah, that is one option. Another one option is to actually, if you have more than one axis, you just drop down the values of x you're using by a factor. And then you can chase it down further. And both of them will work. And the distribution doesn't really get changed because it's going to happen only in a very last few steps. And this is actually doesn't affect the averages at all. But if you don't do it, it can become, at times can become very big, although it's very rare. Statistically speaking. I don't know how to... I don't have a method to bound that particular probability. No. Sorry. Okay, good question. So allow me to answer that. So for side-channel persistence data structures, what we did is that, I can give you the paper if you want to start. If you know this paper by Ostrowski and Goldreich, which has got this oblivious simulation of RAMs, which basically makes every program run equivalent to a random program run, which runs accesses everything and changes everything at random. But usually programs work well because of locality of reference. And if you're going to destroy it, you might as well throw the computer too. It's very difficult to... Well, locality of reference is the big thing in computer program running. So what we define is a data structure, like a splay tree variant of it, which has the following property that if the original sequence of data adds some amount of average entropy for access depth, this will actually come very close to it. But given any variable, after t steps, if I ask you where that variable resides in the memory, there's a lower bound on the number of locations in which you have to look at before you can correctly say which one of them it is. So that's a variant of it, and it's actually, since play tree is an extremely practical thing, not very well noticed fact, this actually works out reasonably well, and you can actually prove everything that you want to do. We haven't published it, but it's available for distribution now. So that one can actually be used and changed a little bit to store your RSA data structures in kind of a pre-format, and you self-adjustingly modify it so that people who do timing attack won't get exactly where it is located. That's the main idea.